Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, today we are going to begin our discussion of Thomas More's Utopia. And I'm really excited to do that. But before we get into our discussion, I thought what I'd do is just give you maybe a little bit more background about Thomas More. And just to kind of remind you that he was, let's say, an important governmental figure in England when he wrote this book. Remember, it was written in 1516. But More was, by training, a lawyer. He was also a social philosopher. And by that, I think what we should maybe understand from being a social philosopher, he was very much interested in government and how governments were organized and how society was organized and what was the best way to govern a society. And so there's so much that you could learn about Thomas More. Now, a lot of people call him Sir Thomas More, but actually in the Catholic Church, he's one of the saints. And he's the patron saint of politicians, by the way. And so it is really, really quite interesting that way. But he really studied the classics. And what you have to understand about this book, Utopia, he really did base a lot of it on Plato's Republic. Now, I've personally never read Plato's Republic. I'm not necessarily advocating that you read Plato's Republic. If you're really inspired by this book, maybe you might want to read Plato's Republic. But he certainly believed in what Plato was doing, and we can even see that as we get towards the end of Book One, where he really does a lot of publicity for Plato and Plato's Republic. But remember, that book, Plato's Republic, was written around 380 BC. So I know a lot of people, even those of us that are on this panel today, we've kind of choked at reading through some of More's writing. So I can't imagine going all the way back to 380 BC and reading Plato's Republic. But I'm sure they've done a lot of good translations of it. Now, the thing is, Plato's Republic is not a novel. It's a book about, well, what's the best republic? And I think in the introduction that we had on our special program, we talked to you about the whole idea of the idea of a utopia is to, well, what is a perfect society? And we even showed you that, you know, if you go into a bookstore, you're not going to find many books on utopia because, well, basically, I think human beings have some honesty is, well, we're never going to be able to produce one the way we are now. But that doesn't mean we won't be able to. But that's more for the end of the series. But again, the Republic is not a novel. And essentially, Thomas More's Utopia, you've probably deduced by now that it's also not a novel. But it is very structured. It's purposely organized by Thomas More. And it is a little bit confusing. I know when I first started reading it, I thought, wow, I don't even know where this is going. But then once I caught on to what was happening, it really is kind of interesting. So the book opens, Book One opens, and basically what you have to understand is that More isn't interested in writing a novel, but he was so much into Plato that essentially what he's doing is he's opening up some discussion about government. And he's opening up some discussion about princes or kings. He's opening up discussion about economy. He's also opening up discussion on, how do you manage a society? And so it's very political in a way. But it can be a little confusing because it doesn't seem like there's any plot. He does use some fictional characters. Actually, when you're starting to read Book One, when you read about Mr. More or Thomas More, it's actually not Thomas More. It's actually a fictional character, Thomas More. And even though it is really set at the time of Henry VIII, and that is historical, Thomas More was a leading counselor to Henry VIII. That is not fictional. But the Thomas More that is the narrator of the book is fictional character. And there was really good reason for that, because if you look at what he's doing in that book one, he's taking some pretty hard slaps at the way the king was running the country. And so we know that eventually More lost his head anyway to Henry VIII. Thomas More was an advocate of Catholicism. He was a very staunch Catholic. He would not agree to Henry VIII's divorce of, Catherine. And so essentially he lost his head for treason anyway. But this book wasn't even published till well after Henry VIII's death, because English people just didn't like treasonous works, but it really did criticize the country. So we'll talk about this more as we go along. Now, the thing is, there's really like no plot at the very beginning. It is a conversation, and essentially I think what's great about book one, and there is some real, I think, genius in its writing, is essentially what Thomas More is doing. And remember, this was written, hundreds of years ago. But essentially what he wants is he wants you, the reader, to start thinking about these big issues. And he wants you to wrestle with the idea of how would you build a perfect society? And what would a perfect society be like? And so he's like taking you into a conversation. And in some ways, it's like you're entering into the middle of a movie and you really have to catch up. And I think we're going to be able to help you with that. But you have to start thinking for yourself. What do you think a perfect society would be? How would you rule that your society yourself if you were the king? And so it is really quite interesting. Now, with me in the studio today to help do this is the 60-plus panel. And I know it's been a while since we've been together. I finished the Bible series. I was very selfish. I did that all by myself. But so with me in the studio today is Mr. Daryl Hope.
Thank you. Nice to be here. It's utopic to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're back. And also with me here is my sweet wife, Deborah Leap. And, of course, we don't need to give them more introduction. You've heard them a lot yourselves. So let me just I'll just throw it out and be honest. Let me just ask the first big question. So what did you think of reading the book? What's your big overview? Who wants to go first? I'll let whoever takes the mic first.
Ladies first.
Okay, well it is it does make you think about society, and because I really had no I did had no idea what this would be about, and I was taken at first by the discussion about how thieves should not be executed, that it seems like the crime is not fish, the crime and the punishment don't fit, and I thought that was interesting. So I was thinking about that, and didn't think about the fact that at that time period that it was very really, society was very brutal in a lot of ways, and then brings up this whole argument of why were they thieves, and there was a lot of poverty, and then it goes into the whole economics and all that. But it was just that struck me at first.
Yeah, it's not a very comfortable reading, is it?
No.
We just in the sophomore English class, we're going through Tale of Two Cities, and of course that's about the French Revolution. And that was a much later than even this time period, and it was still brutal. And, even Charles Dickens was so concerned about what was happening in England. That's why he wrote about the French Revolution, because these kind of things were still going on. I mean, people were getting hung and executed and had their heads cut off for small things. And this has been a problem, in England. And Thomas More, really, he's opening up to this discussion. And he wants us all to think about it. But he's also really taken some hard slaps at what was going on legally in England. So, okay.
Well, the novel, the topic of the novel, the title of the book, is something that you know, appealed to me from the very start, because I wanted to read about, well, what's the concept now of utopia in the eyes of someone in the 16th century? So when I was reading the book, I started off the first section. I was like, well, we're going to get through this, you know, with Raphael and this discussion. Like, okay, get on with the discussion now. I want to get to utopia. And so finally they start to utopia and start to talk about that, and that's very it's very interesting. It's sort of the gist of what the book is all about. But that whole first portion, that whole first part of the book, which I sort of, you know, overlooked in a sense, really has a lot of meat in it. And it is a very good introduction to everything that follows after it, because of all the concepts that are brought up and all the talk about, well, what really does form a good society and how does it function? And so that sort of primes the pump for the utopia discussion that comes later.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think we've talked about Raphael's name. I think I mentioned before when, of course, in our very first program at the introduction, that the word utopia is really a blend of two Greek words. You means no, and topos means place. So you know, more plays with words. So utopia can mean no place, but then also if you take the other word, a Greek word, eu, which means happy, and you put it with topos, you get happy place. And so I think Moore was really, first of all, trying to protect himself, you know, from getting his head cut off, even though we know it happened anyway. But he's also, I think, saying, you know, that people really don't believe it's possible to have a utopia. And I think, you know, what he's doing, I guess it was part of the educational system at that time, you would have these Socratic discussions before you got into the real education. And so we're kind of getting a view of what it would have been like to maybe been in his classroom and, you know, have these discussions. But you know, and really, I think in the really good universities, and we've talked about this on the radio as well, that, you know, people don't have discussion anymore in universities because everybody has to, you know, follow the party line. But I think years ago, you know, I know when I was in college, we had great discussions and not everyone agreed with each other, but we didn't, you know, well, murder each other either, you know? So I do think it's really kind of fascinating that way. The thing that I thought about, the whole, let's say the overall, way it hit me, especially book one, is one, I think it showed me that I don't know as much as I thought I did. and it also shows me that, you know, I really need to do a lot more thinking about, you know, government and society and, you know, even in terms of what, let's say, like, I need to do as a person, what I need to do to help make a better society. And, you know, I have always been one, I think I've made this comment before, that my mother was a Democrat and my father was a Republican, and they would get into the real battles over, you know, decisions that the Republicans were making or the decisions their Democrats were making. And I just, at that point, I just thought, man, I don't want to have anything to do with politics. I don't want to have anything to do with you know, who cares? I just have my life. That's all that matters. But you know, at the end of book one, we see that you know, Moore really does bring us into a Christian understanding of government. And if you really look at Christ's gospel, and I mean, everybody knows that this is a, you know, this JBL is backed up by a religious organization, the Philadelphia Church of God sponsors it. And of course, we have Herbert W. Armstrong College, which is also sponsored by the Philadelphia Church of God. We do know that Christ's gospel is all about government and actually what it takes to develop a perfect society. And so I'm really kind of excited to be doing this book because it's challenging me to think more. But you brought up Raphael Hithelode. And just to explain that name, if you haven't read the very beginning of your book, in the introduction, Raphael, it's taken from an apocryphal book that was supposedly an archangel. But we know that the Apocrypha isn't part of established scripture. But it means healing. And Hithelode means nonsense. So, or other people have explained it as Raphael could be a talker, I guess, or, you know, and as a talker of nonsense. I do think there's a lot of satire in the book as well. And it's kind of a heavy subject, but I think the satire is there. And so here, Raphael Hithloday has all these really wise things, but, you know, is he talking nonsense or is he talking good things? So that's how it all hit me. So any other comments now?
One of the things that you mentioned, though, where you spoke around that was in the first part of the book that I thought was also interesting in regard to this whole issue of looking at government. In one of the conversations that takes place, I think the lawyer says, well, this could never happen in England. This could never work in England. Because when he's explaining how things need to change with regard to the way thieves are handled and they're punished and so forth, it's like the established society sort of says, well, we're not going to look at any change because it just won't work here. So they're not willing to even try to change or look at anything else. You know, and that's so typical of established societies, that they don't want to look at anything different. They keep it the way it is.
Yeah, it's like the elite Republicans today and the elite Democrats.
Right.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with the Democratic Party.
Right. The way it is.
The elite Republicans feel there's nothing wrong with the Republican Party, so they got Donald Trump because a lot of the people in this country don't think the elite Republicans are doing such a good job. Well, I thought it was, let me just maybe to connect the people, our listeners, I wanted to go to the page 3 of, and this is the Dover Thrift Edition. This is the one I recommended to them. But I think it's interesting that there is a lot of history here in the book. And like I said, we just said that it's novel-like, but it's not a novel. It's really an open discussion, you know, about government. Notice the very, this would be probably the very first page, so you could all, I actually bought the 60 plus panel, a different version, so they're struggling right now, and I apologize for that. But it's interesting that, of course, Henry VIII is a real character. We know that he lived at a very difficult time, and he actually had created a lot of problems for himself and in the government. And notice that Thomas More is very, very kind to him. He calls him the unconquered king of England. And he said he's a prince adorned with all virtues, and that became a great monarch. Now, I think history would disagree with all that, you know, because how many wives did he have? Did he end up having 7? You know, I know the Beatles, I don't know how many they said, but we can't trust the Beatles anyway. So, but he's a real character. The Charles that they're talking about in that first sentence there, or first couple sentences, Charles V, and he was the Holy Roman Emperor at the time. And so what he's saying, this is not actually Thomas More as the narrator. It's actually Thomas Morus, if you look at the Latin. And it's not More the author. But he was being sent to Charles as an ambassador to solve some problems between the emperor and Henry VIII. Now, that probably happened, but it's fictional, but it's also, he's using a great technique of he's keeping us right involved in history. Then there's Cuthbert Tonstall, and he was an actual English scholar. He was a church leader. He was also a diplomat. And so here, this fake character, I mean, we talk about fake news today, so even more new about fake characters. So the fake character is going on this mission to Charles V for Henry VIII, and they're trying to get some things smoothed out with the Holy Roman Emperor. Now, Peter Giles is also a real person, and he was a great friend to Thomas More. He was Dutch, very smart guy, and all that. So you know, those are really quite interesting. Now, the thing that for those of you that are maybe struggling with reading it, he really does bring in, you know, some things that are like inventions. The bottom of page 3, he's talking about, you know, sailing ships and how sailing ships had opened up the world to people. And he says they're the first vessels that they saw were flat-bottomed. Their sails were made of reeds and wicker woven close together. Only some were of leather. But afterwards, they found ships that were made with keels. and canvas sails in all respects like our ships, and the seamen understood both astronomy and navigation. He got wonderfully into their favor by showing them the use of the needle, and he's really talking about the compass. And so he brings a little bit about invention, I think, just to throw in an interest. But if you go over to the next page, page 4, they're talking about when they get to Castile or New Castile, and that's where that was the center of the Holy Roman Empire at that time. So he says, we asked them many questions concerning all these things, to which he answered very willingly, only we made no inquiries after monsters, than which nothing is more common, for everywhere one may hear of ravenous dogs and wolves and cruel man-eaters. But it is not so easy to find states that are well and wisely governed. And so essentially what Moore is saying right up front, look, we're not talking about traveling to all these other countries to find about what monsters are there or what, you know, what the really cool things, like what the foods are like. He's saying, we want to talk about these other countries because of government. And so he really sets us up for that. And so that's what's really going on. Now, to catch everybody up with the story, so once he gets, you know, they actually end up in Antwerp, and he meets this what he considers this kind of a ragtag bag guy named Raphael, who he thinks is a seaman, but it turns out Peter Giles tells him, well, he's really a smart guy. And this would be page 5 in my book. But essentially what they find out is that he has studied government, and he's studied about all these governments, and he's really wise. And so what they want him to do is they say, well, look, if you're so wise, why aren't you, an attendant servant to a king? And he says, if we just pick up on page 5, Raphael begins to answer. He says, now I live as I will, to which I believe few courtiers can pretend. In other words, he's saying, look, I don't have to do what the king wants. And not that he was being rebellious, but he was saying, look, I don't have to do what the king wants. He says, and there are so many that the court, the favor of great, the favor of great men, that there will be no great loss if they are not troubled either with me or with any of my temper. Upon this, said I, perceive, Raphael, that you are neither desire wealth nor greatness. Now, this is Thomas Morris speaking. And he's saying, and indeed I value and admire such a man more than I do any of the great men in the world. Yet I think you would do well, become so generous and philosophical a soul as yours is, if you would apply your time and thoughts to public affairs, even though you may happen to find it a little uneasy to yourself, and this you can never do with so much advantage as being into the counsel of some great prince and putting him on noble and worthy actions, which I know you would do if you were in such a post, for the springs both of good and evil flow from the prince. And so here they're saying, look, you know, all kings can be evil, you know, as well as good. And so of course, Raphael has his responses. And if you look at this book, the way book one is, essentially, they keep pressing, Morris and Giles keep pressing Raphael to become a servant of a king. And he gives 4 reasons why he's not going to become a servant of the king. And he just gives one of them there is like, look, kings can do evil things. One of the first things he says is, again, it's on the same page. He says, I don't want to be, a slave to a king or a servant to a king. He says, because neither have I any knowledge nor do I desire it. And he's talking about the kings. They are generally more set on acquiring new kingdoms, right or wrong, than on governing well they possess. And so that's his first discussion. So any comments on that? I know you guys have read these discussions. So
I think it's great that this whole method of discussion which allows Raphael a chance to speak in opposition to certain things that no one would dare speak about otherwise. It provides the forum in which he can say these things like princes are generally more set on acquiring new kingdoms, right or wrong, than governing well those whom they possess. I mean, no one could ever say that forthrightly. But when you have it in the context of discussion like this, you can say that and get away with it. And that's what's good about having Raphael doing this, is that it allows him to give these points and actually really give some input on perhaps how the writer himself feels about certain things about, we don't really know that, but how he may feel about certain things that are going on politically at the time.
Yes, I definitely think that there's a lot of Moore's thinking, even in Raphael. I mean, we have to agree with that. Well, you know, I just looked at the clock. You know what that means? We're really running out of time. All right, listeners, sorry we're running out of time, but next time we'll continue our discussion of Book One from Thomas More's much-studied work, Utopia. If you have not started reading Moore's Utopia, there's still time. The Dover Thrift Edition is available at Amazon for about $3. If you're not a Prime member, it's probably going to make it about $5. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
Been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.